to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. Several months ago, it was my pleasure to interview the best-selling author, Iris Chang, on two of her books, The Rape of Nanking and The Chinese in America. On November 12, 2004, Iris Chang was found dead in her car of a self-inflicted gunshot. She was 36. Last week, we aired the first of my conversations with Iris about the rape of Nanking. This week, she and I discussed The Chinese in America. Following that, Talking History's Fiona Beattie will tell us where we can learn more about the Chinese in America, and William Lambers will provide our commentary of the week, this time on a Cold War initiative that might be useful in advancing the current Indian-Pakistani peace process. But first, let's take a look at two items of historical interest in the news, one on China and the other on Japan. The Chinese were consuming fermented beverages, possibly wine, as long as 9,000 years ago, according to a recent report by Patrick McGovern of the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. McGovern, you may recall, was on this show not too long ago discussing his work to that point, which established the earliest evidence of fermented beverages in the ancient Middle East. He and his team of researchers have now found evidence in the form of residue on pieces of Chinese pottery, indicating the presence of such beverages even earlier in China's Henan province. The residue, estimated at between 7,000 and 9,000 years old, contains traces of rice, rice wine, grape tannins, and ancient herbs. This is the same site, incidentally, where archaeologists found the earliest evidence of musical instruments, an ancient flute. McGovern reported his latest findings in the December issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Turning to Japanese history, Japan's education minister has praised recently adopted history textbooks in that country's schools for cutting back on criticism of Japan's actions during World War II. There was a time when Japanese textbooks were full of nothing but extremely self-tormenting things saying that Japan was bad, Education Minister Nariaki Nakayama explained. We have tried to correct that. I'm really glad that recently there are fewer words such as comfort woman and forced relocation used in textbooks. It's very important to teach the children of Japan so that they can live with pride in their race and in their history. The comment was immediately criticized by historians who noted that at least 200,000 young women, known as comfort women, most from Korea but also from China, the Philippines, and Indonesia, were forced to serve as sex slaves in Japanese army brothels during the war. And soon after Nakayama made his remarks, Japan's Supreme Court ruled against a damages suit brought by South Koreans who were forced to work as sex slaves by the Japanese Imperial Army while it occupied that country. The court said that their suffering during World War II cannot be compensated under Japan's post-war constitution. The 35 plaintiffs, including relatives of Koreans who died, had demanded that Tokyo pay them 20 million yen, about $190,000 each, for their suffering. To date, Japan has refused to publicly apologize for its actions during the war, including the rape of Nanking, that was the subject of our interview last week with Iris Chang. When we return, Chang and I discuss the history of the Chinese in America. This is Talking History. The interview you are about to hear was conducted before the death of Iris Chang. She was in our studio at radio station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Joining us in our studio today for the second in our two-part interview is best-selling author Iris Chang. Last week, we discussed her book, The Rape of Nanking, published in 1997. This week, we take up her most recent book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History, published by Penguin Books. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Okay. This is really an epic story. It covers the Chinese in America over a 150-year period, and we can't begin to cover it all, but let's at least hit some of the high points, and let's start by looking at a model that historians commonly use, and you use it because it's such an effective way of explaining immigration, but it may not be familiar to all of our audience, essentially the push-pull model. Maybe you could just define that very briefly. What do we mean by the push-pull model?
Well, by that we mean that immigration may be motivated by push-pull forces, a force pushing people out of the country of origin, and another force pulling people in.
Right. And this has got to be substantial because it's very difficult. We perhaps minimize how difficult it is for someone to leave your homeland and go to another country. And then the other factor being just because you've decided to leave, it doesn't mean automatically you're going to come to the United States. And in fact, one thing we'll talk about later, if we have time, is that the Chinese did go to other places in the world, not just to the United States.
That's right. During the 19th century, conditions were so bad in China that there was a diaspora of Chinese across the whole world. And the United States was really only one of the many destinations that they headed to.
Okay, let's build on that. Let's talk about the 19th century migration of the Chinese and tell us about that.
Well, the 19th century was a time of floods and famine and civil strife in China itself. And so that was a major push factor. And at the same time, in the United States, there were enormous economic opportunities, and many of the Chinese from the Toishan County region saw the United States as an opportunity to expand upon various entrepreneurial ventures or to find gold, as it was at the time the heyday of the gold rush. And we have to keep in mind that some of the pull factors include a severe manpower shortage in the United States. And just raw physical labor was needed to transform the frontier into land for agriculture, to build the Transcontinental Railroad, to fill the expanding factories. So it was a time of great economic growth for the United States.
Great economic growth and great need, of course, for labor. But Chinese immigration is something very new. In fact, anything outside of generally European and Northern European immigration at this point is new. What's the reception of the Chinese?
Well, in the beginning, before the Chinese became a major threat to white Americans, they were warmly welcomed. Sometimes they even found great success, even in the American South, where two very famous Chinese, Chang and Ong Bunker, the celebrated Siamese twins, married white women, fathered, I think, 21 children between them, and even owned their own plantations, complete with 33 black slaves. You see, in regions where they weren't really seen as a major threat, they were often embraced as being frugal, as being intelligent, and they were often treated as members of the community. Now, that wasn't always the case when times turned sour, when America suffered an economic depression.
And then what happened?
Well, in the 1870s, during a time of great economic depression, the whites began to fear that the Chinese would take jobs away from them. In the city of San Francisco, there were soon about two white men and one Chinese man looking for every job in the city. And after the stock market had crashed, after the gold mines had emptied out and the labor shortage had disappeared because Civil War veterans were traveling through the country looking for work, many white working men began to see the Chinese as strikebreakers, as a great threat to their livelihoods. And they began to organize themselves politically to shut the gates of immigration, Chinese immigration, to this country.
Do you think this is because the Chinese were, and I use this term advisedly, but the most foreign of the immigrants, and that it was easier to deal with and perhaps more difficult to come out against, let's say, the Irish that were coming in large numbers at that time?
Well, the Chinese were, being one of the more recent immigrant groups, was definitely an easy scapegoat for some of these problems.
Okay. You alluded earlier to Chinese going to the South, and so let me ask you to develop that. Most of us perhaps only think of the Chinese in terms of being in California, but yet they really did disperse around the country. So where did they go and why?
They moved across the country to the East Coast, to the Midwest, and to the South. And I don't think it's well known, but there was a time in the American South where white plantation owners considered the idea of replacing black slavery with Chinese labor. What they didn't realize was that the Chinese employees on their plantations would often hire lawyers or agents to negotiate their contracts, hiring translators even to prepare equivalent documents in Chinese, and also suing their employers if they didn't pay them on time.
Interesting idea. Another interesting point to me personally was you make reference to the Chinese in my hometown, North Adams, Massachusetts, in 1870. So for my own edification, tell us a bit about that.
Absolutely. Well, the Chinese were brought into that town as strikebreakers by the Sampson Shoe Factory, and it was quite an event for the town at first, because many of the locals had never seen a Chinese person before. And when they arrived, they were hooted and booed. But very quickly, some of them found acceptance in North Adams. They would attend Sunday school or language classes. Some of them would later marry Caucasian women. Actually, one of the youths who ended up working in North Adams eventually became a major Chinese-American horticulturalist and helped develop a frost-resistant orange that revolutionized the citrus industry in Florida. So it's really an amazing story.
It's a good story. It implies, and I want to make sure to take this up, that the Chinese came to the United States to stay and found acceptance and settled down. Yet you make another important point that historians have tried to develop but perhaps hasn't been popularized, and the idea that most immigrants, Chinese were not alone on this, didn't intend to stay in the United States.
I think that's true for all immigrants, or even people who move often between states in the United States, that we often think this is just going to be temporary. We're going to return to our home communities, not realizing, of course, that with the passage of time, that the immigrant changes and going home is often impossible. Regarding the Chinese who came to this country, many of them had wives in their home villages and children, and they fully intended to make as much money as possible and to return home to their villages. But what they often didn't realize was that their capital would be so valuable in China, thanks to the favorable exchange rates, that there was a vested economic interest in having him remain in the United States, the husband remain in the United States, while sending remittances home to his family. And so you had this paradoxical situation of men sometimes toiling away in menial jobs in laundries or in factories, but their families would live like gentry in the Tuyuan County region in China.
Yeah, that's an important point to make, I think. Tell us about the second wave, which is the wave of immigration following the Communist Revolution in China in 1949.
Well, if we were to describe this in terms of push and pull factors, I would say that the second wave was driven out of China by the Communist Revolution, and this was a highly educated professional wave, a wave that included bureaucrats of the nationalist government and capitalists. And the force that would draw them into the United States, the pull wave, would be the scientific opportunities in this country, especially during the Cold War, when this country sought immigrant brain power to counter the rising threat of the Soviet Empire. And my parents were part of this wave. They fled as small children with their families either shortly before or after 1949 from mainland China to Taiwan. And after going to National Taiwan University, my parents came to this country in the 1960s to study at Harvard University to get their doctorates in physics and biology. Their backgrounds are very similar to that of many of their colleagues who also came in the 60s when immigration laws had relaxed and had undergone great changes under Lyndon Johnson.
Okay, so they came as students and then just stayed on after that?
Yes, as professors.
Of?
Physics and biology. And I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, in that university town where they taught.
Okay. Third wave, the last couple decades, describe that movement.
Well, the third wave came as a result of the lifting of the bamboo curtain and the end of the Cold War, the end of the tensions between the United States and China, and during a great period of economic partnerships and exchanges, especially during the Reagan Dung years. And this is a wave that encompasses all socioeconomic groups, ranging from the Chinese mogul to professionals who commute between countries. You know, there's that phenomenon of parachute kids and astronauts, which I discuss in my book, people whose families have really been sundered by these economic forces of transnationalism. It also embraces people who are here illegally, sweatshop workers.
Okay. You point to some of the differences among the Chinese that come at these three different time periods. I wonder if you could somehow step back and say, in what ways were they alike?
I think they were all alike in that they all shared a great reverence for education and frugality, family values. Some of them also had an entrepreneurial spirit. You could view the history of the Chinese in America as part of a larger immigration pattern or even economic pattern of the middlemen minority phenomenon. The Chinese, along with certain other ethnic groups such as Jews, Armenians, and Lebanese, are considered some of the great middlemen minority groups in the world, and they serve a specific economic function in which often they will bring a capitalistic role in their host countries and create economies through their entrepreneurial abilities and also facilitate the flow of goods between the producers and the consumers. And it's interesting to note that throughout history, when times are prosperous, the middlemen minorities, the Jews, the Armenians, the Lebanese, and the Chinese, have often greatly prospered and thrived. In fact, I should mention, for example, like all of the billionaires in Southeast Asia are ethnic Chinese. It's an example of that phenomenon. But when economic conditions worsen, these groups are usually the most heavily scapegoated and the most persecuted groups in the world.
Good point. Last question, very quickly. Where else did the Chinese go in large numbers other than the United States?
They went to South America. They've gone all over the world. But some of their greatest influence has been in Southeast Asia, where I had just mentioned they have often very little political power, but tremendous economic power.
You mentioned they're going to the South. Again, I want to come back to that. Did the various immigrant groups had tendencies to go to certain types of areas, whether it be urban or rural or farming or industrial? Did the Chinese have a particular pattern there?
The Chinese tended to be more of an urban people and would assume often specific economic roles, often in retail or in positions where they would pretty much serve as middlemen minorities or often as professionals and intellectuals. But in the United States, it hadn't always been the case. Sometimes they thrived in rural areas too, but would bring crucial services to those regions, such as grocers or small businessmen and merchants. But by and large, they did tend to migrate to the cities.
Okay, well, thank you. This is, as I said in the opening, an epic book, 500 pages of lots of detail and interesting stories. It can serve, I think, both as a reference book for people doing work in immigration as well as just a good read for the popular audience. So congratulations again on a great book.
Thank you so much. Right,
thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Iris Chang, the author of The Chinese in America, A Narrative History, and this is Talking History. For her site of the week, Talking History's Fiona Beatty tells us where we can further explore the history of the Chinese in America.
They arrived on American soil, filled with hopes, dreams, and without a penny to their name, and for over 20 years the Museum of the Chinese in America has been amassing a collection dedicated to documenting that journey and to preserving Chinese immigrant heritage. Located in the heart of Manhattan's Chinatown, in former Public School 23, built specifically during the 19th century to educate new immigrants, the museum has collaborated with New York University to create the Mapping Our Heritage project. Utilizing the latest in interactive technology, the project kiosk provides a wide range of information on Chinatown, including oral histories and statistical and biographical data. It also invites visitors to share personal histories and memories of the area. And if you can't visit the museum in person, fear not. Their website has extensive links to excellent resources. Click on the Research Resources link to find specialist library collections, museums, projects, and study programs, among them the Chinese Historical Societies of America website, including the Daniel K. E. Ching collection of depictions in popular culture of Chinese Americans in the 19th and 20th century. To find out more about the Museum of the Chinese in America, go to www.moca-nyc.org.
Finally, for our commentary of the week, William Lambert looks back a half century to find a possible solution, or at least a good next step, in pursuit of peace in the conflict between India and Pakistan. Lambert is the author of The Road to Peace, From the Disarming of the Great Lakes to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty.
There is encouraging news about ending the decades-old conflict between India and Pakistan. At the United Nations, the leaders of both nations recently expressed their desire for peaceful coexistence and called for confidence-building measures. India and Pakistan are both armed with nuclear weapons. The two nations have frequently exchanged gunfire in the region of Kashmir, which both claim. In 2002, when hundreds of thousands of Indian and Pakistani troops massed on their respective borders, war seemed imminent. The crisis subsided, but the urgent need for peace between the two adversaries remained. How can the United States aid the Indian-Pakistani peace process? By means of an old Cold War initiative, originally proposed by the United States. In 1955, in the midst of the Cold War, President Eisenhower presented a diplomatic surprise to the Soviet Union. Why not allow both the Americans and Soviets to fly unarmed aerial observation missions over each other's military facilities? Such a move, the president surmised, could reduce the possibility of secret military preparations and help build trust through transparency. As Eisenhower stated, open skies would have the effect of lessening danger and relaxing tension between the two heavily armed rivals. The Soviets didn't accept Eisenhower's idea in 1955. In fact, it took nearly 40 years to implement it. In 1992, the United States, Canada, Russia, and other European nations signed the Open Skies Treaty, allowing unarmed aerial observation flights over the respective territories of each nation. A similar arrangement would benefit India and Pakistan, who fear each other's military might. Open Skies missions would provide that Indian and Pakistani officials work together on observation flights. This type of cooperation would set the groundwork for future disarmament agreements. Clearly, a stable Pakistan at peace with India is in the best interest of the entire world. Adopting an open skies agreement will help create the atmosphere India and Pakistan need to resolve their disputes. Its successful implementation would set a formidable model for arms control and peace that other regions of the globe could emulate. The United States and NATO can offer considerable expertise in open skies to help formulate the agreement. An open skies initiative will help lay the foundation for amicable relations between India and Pakistan. This is one of many steps that will be needed to achieve peace in South Asia. The stakes are high. A failure to resolve the differences between India and Pakistan will prolong tension in South Asia and increase the chance of war.
Please believe me when I say that the dream of world domination by one power or of world conformity is an impossible dream. The nature of today's weapons, the nature of modern communications, and the widening circle of new nations make it plain that we must, in the end, be a world community of open societies. And the concept of the open society is the ultimate key to a system of arms control we all can trust. We must then seek with new vigor, new initiative, the path to a peace based on the effective control of armaments.
You've been listening to William Lambers, the author of The Road to Peace, From the Disarming of the Great Lakes to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, and a writer for the History News Service. That's it for another week of Talking History. Once again, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beattie is our crack producer, and that Alex Smith is our ace studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.